You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the disposal of your household trash is a highly engineered process, and it's come a long way. Gone are the days of digging a hole and calling it the city dump. Instead, we have carefully planned and monitored sites. We'll talk to an engineering expert about Wisconsin's landfills, present, past, and future. Now, President Trump pardoned conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza last week for campaign finance violations. The president also hinted at pardoning lifestyle celebrity Martha Stewart and commuting the sentence for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. He had also previously pardoned Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Vice President Dick Cheney's former advisor Scooter Libby. And the president claimed this week that he has the authority to pardon himself amid the ongoing Russia investigation, though he maintains he's done nothing wrong. Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor in the Department of History at American University and the author of several books. His latest is The Case for Impeachment. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, do you see a common message in the president's pardons and the people he's talking about pardoning? Any common themes standing out to you?
I see three common themes. Number one, his pardons have nothing to do with whether these people are really guilty of the crimes for which they were convicted, and two, it has nothing to do with whether or not these folks are remorseful for their crimes. Secondly, the president has utterly ignored all standard procedures with which pardons usually go through careful vetting in the United States Department of Justice. And three, by pardoning people with whom he is politically compatible, he is sending a message to those who have been charged and may be charged in the future by Robert Mueller that they might well face a pardon. And remember, almost all of those that he pardoned were not individuals charged with ordinary crime, but with corrupt acts.
Yeah, let's look at the pardon of Dinesh D'Souza, the most recent actual pardon for campaign finance charges. As you mentioned, he was charged with the Corrupt Act and did plea guilty, I believe, in court for that. What was the president's rationale for that pardon?
Well, the president doesn't give much rationales or factual background for anything. Basically, he said that D'Souza was being treated very unfairly, implying, of course, just like he is being treated very unfairly by this so-called deep state justice club. In fact, D'Souza, as you say, pleaded guilty. He was called caught red-handed. There's no indication that he wasn't guilty of a corrupt act, for which I don't believe he even got any jail time.
And you mentioned the idea of signaling with these pardons. Do you think that this is mainly intended for the audience of people who might be under investigation, facing charges by the Mueller probe, and might be considering cooperating with the Mueller probe?
Absolutely. The last thing President Trump wants is anyone who has any knowledge of what was going on in the campaign cooperating with Mueller. There are already quite a few important people cooperating with Mueller. But one of those who he surely does not want cooperating with Mueller is Paul Manafort, his former campaign chair, who was involved as the campaign chair at a critical juncture of the campaign at the very point when Donald Trump was being nominated by the Republican Party for the presidency.
Talking to Alan Lichtman, distinguished professor in the Department of History at American University, about the pardon process, how it's been used recently by President Trump. Alan, I want to compare and contrast with a couple of controversial pardons of the past. First, going back to President Gerald Ford pardoning his predecessor, Richard Nixon. Can you talk about that, how that fits into the history of the pardon process?
Yeah, that was, of course, the most unusual pardon in the history of the country, pardoning a former president and basically issuing a blanket pardon. It wasn't a pardon for any specific crime because he hadn't been charged with anything yet, but it was a blank check pardoning him for any charges that could be brought against him. And, of course, that at the time was enormously controversial, hurt the Ford presidency. But believe me, I'm no friend of Richard Nixon. I've been very critical of him. But I think Gerald Ford actually did the right thing. And the reason is Nixon was already removed from office. He had no power. He was a private citizen. And if, in fact, Nixon had been charged and tried in a court of law, it would have ruined the Ford presidency, because that's all that the American people would have been focused on, would be the spectacular trials of Richard Nixon. I think Ford had to pardon Nixon if he wanted a presidency.
And then people point to the President Clinton pardon of Mark Rich, a supporter of the Clintons, as a controversial one. What do you make of that one?
Yeah, I think that was probably an unwise pardon. I really didn't see the rationale for that pardon, other than perhaps cashing in on a political favor. But this is, you know, if he were to pardon Manafort and others, this is totally different, because there wasn't any issue about Mark Rich having anything on Bill Clinton. In fact, that happened, right, I think, right at the end of the Clinton presidency. But to pardon people in order to avoid them testifying against you is unique in all of American history. This is not comparable to the Jimmy Hoffa pardon, to the Richard Nixon pardon, to the Mark Rich pardon. This is something new, and I think it's part of what I see as an extensive pattern on the part of the president to do everything in his power to derail, disrupt, and to discredit the investigation.
And President Trump tweeted, as has been stated, I'm quoting here, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself, but why would I do that when I've done nothing wrong? So that's a big question. Does the president have the power to pardon the president?
Before I get into that, let me say, why would you even bring it up if you're totally innocent? That just makes no sense. Second, it is an unsettled question, of course. It's never happened. But I think it's utterly contrary to the Constitution. Constitution makes it explicit a president can't pardon himself for impeachment. It then goes on to say, if a president is impeached and removed, he is then subject for prosecution and conviction of any crimes. If, in fact, the president could pardon himself, why have that part of the Constitution even in existence? Because the president could easily vitiate it by issuing a pardon of himself during an impeachment process. So it makes no sense in terms of what's actually in the Constitution for the president to have the power to pardon himself. You know, I would go back to George Washington. When George Washington issued his first extensive pardons, he pardoned individuals involved in the whiskey anti-tax rebellion. And he said, you know, I exercise this power only with the greatest compassion and circumspection, and only for people who are truly remorseful, and keeping always in mind the dignity of the president and how he represents the national interest. All I can say is Donald Trump is no George Washington.
Now, you are well known for your predictions of the outcome of presidential races. Looking at a bunch of fundamentals, you had predicted the election of Donald Trump as president. And then you've been in the news. You predicted early in his term that it wasn't going to end well for him one way or another. You thought impeachment or some other removal from office in the works. Is that still something you're expecting?
Absolutely. You know, when I first published my book, The Case for Impeachment, it was about a year and a quarter ago, about 15 months ago, people said, come on, Lichtman, you know, the president's barely been in office. How could you possibly be predicting impeachment? Come on, you're way out of the limb. And lo and behold, who's talking about impeachment? The president's own lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who in fact said if the president pardoned himself, we would go directly to impeachment. So all of a sudden, impeachment, something that I was talking about so long ago, has become mainstream. And I do think it's going to happen, because I do think what we know about this awful conspiracy with the Russians to destroy our democracy, what we know publicly is bad enough, and it's the tip of the iceberg, I believe, of what Robert Mueller knows. And I think there are going to be some devastating indictments coming down, which are going to put the Republicans in the position of either moving towards impeachment or losing at the polls in November and the Democrats taking over, and then they can impeach the president with no Republican votes.
We'll leave it there, Alan. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Alan Lichtman, distinguished professor in the Department of History at American University. He joined us today to talk about President Trump and the powers of the presidential pardon. First, while the garbage industry may not be glamorous, we do contribute to it just about every day. The maintenance of landfill sites can be costly, even after the site is permanently closed. Portions of two Dane County landfill sites that will be permanently closed later this summer will be planted with pollinator-friendly plants and grasses to support bee and butterfly populations. That's just one example of ways that sites can be repurposed after they're closed. James Tingem is an associate professor in UW-Madison's College of Engineering. He's also the associate chair of the Department of Engineering Professional Development. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, when we think landfill, I think we might think the dump, a big hole in the ground with a bunch of stuff in it. It's not that simple anymore, is it?
Yeah, well, 30 years ago, everywhere, it would be a dump. Literally every city, small town would have a dump. Today, they're very modern engineered facilities. Containment is very good, and we actually recover the energy in these landfills very productively.
Yeah, give us a little landfill 101. What kind of things are happening there now that they wouldn't have, as you say, just a few decades ago?
Well, first, landfills now are very large. They're regional sites. There's only 58 active landfills in Wisconsin. You know, compared to 1990, there was 676 permitted sites. So they're very large structures, take a lot of waste and many different purposes, municipal solid waste, paper mill sludge, foundry sand, a lot of different purposes of what we put into these modern landfills.
And just 58, you said, around the state?
Yeah, 58 active licensed landfills in Wisconsin right now.
And how are we doing with space at those? Are we bursting at the seams, or do we have room to, grow?
We have space to grow, but the permitting process is very intensive. We're encroaching on neighborhoods. So it's a struggle to get new permitted sites in Wisconsin or anywhere.
With the rise of recycling over that time period, are we at least generating waste at a lower rate, or are we still putting a lot of garbage in these sites?
We're trending about equal. We're not really growing. We're not decreasing. That recycled waste is actually getting harder to market because of things going on in China and similar. So we're seeing with general population increase and consumerism, our waste streams are about the same as they have been the last decade.
Let's talk about what happens to an ex-landfill. That was part of why we wanted to call you in here. First of all, you mentioned all those sites that were here in 1990 and that are now deactivated. What happens at one of those sites now?
Yeah, so there's actually 1,778 closed sites in landfills. Generally speaking, what we do, and in combination with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource, is we monitor those landfills. And so there's going to be a active closure, post-closure period of 30 to 40 years. In Wisconsin, there needs to be financial assurance for 40 years of post-closure care. There's lots of things that we can do on these closed sites, including golf courses, dog parks, one of my favorite things because I go to Quan Park all the time, which is a closed city of Madison landfill, solar energy sites. New thing on the block is using these sites for drone or model airplane training sites. A lot of different uses, but the Department of Natural Resources have specific requirements for the development or post-closure use of these landfills.
I imagine there's some fairly nasty stuff in some of these landfills. What do we do to make sure that pollutants don't get into waterways, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's two things that we're really concerned about in landfill, and that's the leachate, or that's the water that enters a landfill, comes in contact with the waste, and then goes to the bottom of the landfill. We collect that because it contains, as you said, kind of nasty things, including volatile organic compounds from paint thinners and things like that. So we need to collect that and treat that. Typically, we take it out of the landfill and send it to a wastewater treatment plant. The other thing that we're really worried about is gas emissions. That's landfill gas and includes methane, again, volatile organic compounds, volatile fatty acids, hydrogen sulfide, and some things that kind of tend to smell bad.
And you mentioned harnessing energy from landfills. With an older landfill that's been decommissioned, are we able to tap, some of that methane for energy?
We definitely are. So one of the older Dane County landfills closed in, I believe, 1987. That is still producing landfill gas. It's being recovered and used to heat a nursing home and also for some electrical production. So we're looking at landfills 30 to 50 years after they receive waste that are still producing methane that we can recover and convert to renewable energy.
Talking to Jim Tingem, associate professor in UW-Madison's College of Engineering, about the life cycle of landfills here in Wisconsin. Jim, I understand you teach a short course for engineering students on landfill design. Is that right?
Yeah, we do. The University of Wisconsin-Madison has been leading in sustainability and environmental management for decades. So I'm just one of a long string of professors and researchers that's been on this. Every spring, we have participants, engineers, practitioners, regulators from across the nation and actually internationally that come to this acclaimed course where we teach the design basics and how to run a very good, modern, protective landfill.
Now with a new landfill or a more recent one, is it designed with that life cycle in mind? Not just how do we open this thing up, but what's going to happen in I don't know how many years when we close it down?
Yeah, we're always cognizant of the life cycle because of what's contained in it. What the dream landfill would be is that you operate it, you collect the leachate, you collect the natural or the methane, convert it to energy, and it biocomposes over time. And maybe 100 years from now, we go in there and mine out the residual metals and waste, productively use everything that's been in there. That would be the dream ultimate recycling project. We're not quite there. We're making progress and we're moving towards that.
Are there places around the world that are doing that or really close to what you're looking for there?
No, it's still kind of a dream or a vision, myself and similar, my like-minded colleagues, to eventually operate it and close a landfill with this in mind, including at the University of Illinois Chicago and other places around the country that have this vision.
Do we think about landfill design in part by thinking upstream, by trying to prevent the use of materials that are going to be a challenge to accommodate at our landfills?
Yeah, that's where recycling programs are very effective, including the paint recovery programs, clean sweep, and similar. If we can keep those hazardous compounds out of the municipal solid waste, and we don't have to worry about those volatile organic compounds into the future. So recycling, not just of the paper and the glass and aluminum is important, but also the recycling and out of those electrical circuits and similar that can cause problems down the line.
You've mentioned a few different projects that have happened on former landfills, dog parks, you mentioned drone training grounds. What are some other creative sites here in Wisconsin or around the world that have caught your eye?
Yeah, I'm going to refer to a site that I visited last November. It's the Rock River Solar Site. It's a 2.25 megawatt solar array on top of a closed coal combustion residuals landfill. That site's been operating since 2016, and it's very innovative because they take the energy from that solar array sitting on top of a landfill and they use it for auxiliary energy purposes for their 700 megawatt natural gas. Ultimately, we're reducing emissions by beneficially reusing that landfill surface for better purposes.
It sounds like that landfill was a specialty site for a particular kind of product. Is that the case for a lot of landfills now?
What we have to do is whatever we do for redevelopment of a landfill, we have to make sure that the cover or cap maintains its integrity. So that causes some difficulties on the foundations that we can put on. Even a solar array requires foundations. But that is a pretty novel project, at least here in Wisconsin, and we'd like to see these in future sites around the world.
Now, if people out there are listening, community members, local city planners, whatever, are thinking, we've got that old landfill. We'd like to do something cool with it. I mean, do you or others at the university could help them out in coming up with a plan for that kind of thing?
Well, we can always help out with ideas. We can help out with landfill gas monitoring. I'd like to point out Dane County Landfill, which is very innovative. For example, they are using their biogas now to convert to pipeline-grade natural gas. That $24 million construction project is starting this year. And so in the years ahead, when you turn on your furnace, your gas stove, part of that natural gas may be coming from your old refuse that you threw out a month ago. Is some pretty innovative stuff that we're doing.
You work in a field that I think a lot of people probably don't think about. The garbage bin was out this morning, it got picked up, and then it went away. Do you feel like people maybe don't take enough interest in where their garbage ends up?
Well, I see it in different perspective. I see everything that you throw away, that's potential energy, that's potential recycling content. So I look at it just favorably of what we can do with it. And like I said, we can engineer these facilities and so that every 500,000 people in Dane County don't have to think about it as much as I do every day. But be assured, our county officials, the Department of Natural Resources, professors such as myself are thinking about this and being very proactive in this area.
And do you see us inching closer to that dream you talked about of getting everything we can, energy and material, out of our landfills?
I think we can actually get there, maybe decades ahead, but where we've come since the 70s when we first started doing modern landfill design, we've come so far in 40 years. I can't imagine where we'll be in another 40 years.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jim Tingem, an associate professor in UW-Madison's College of Engineering. He's an instructor of a yearly course on landfill design. He joined us to talk about landfills around Wisconsin, what the land can be used for once they're closed down. Now, the United States Supreme Court is expected to deliver a ruling on the ongoing Gill versus Whitford case sometime this month. The suit challenges Wisconsin's voting maps and contends that the maps were a result of extreme political gerrymandering. But gerrymandering isn't the only issue that could impact Wisconsin politics this year and into the future. There's also been an influx of outside campaign money and voting law changes that have allegedly impacted turnout in elections. The state of Wisconsin's democracy has been a recent subject of study for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism in its Undemocratic series. Dee Hall is the co-founder and managing editor for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, give us the big picture. Tell us about the series you and students have been working on.
Right. So this was a project that was investigated by my students in a 400-level journalism class here at the UW-Madison. We wanted to take a look at some big themes that I had noticed as a longtime reporter here and as a resident of Wisconsin, some changes that I had seen come to the fore that I think were having an impact on the democracy in our state. And so we had six students. We split into five topics, and we brought in a lot of newsmakers to talk to them and give their perspective on some of these issues.
And give us a sense of the breadth of the subject you covered.
So we looked at, our first piece was already released. We released it at the end of last week on wisconsinwatch.org, and that had to do with redistricting. The issue there, of course, is that in 2011, when the Republicans ran both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, they engaged in a admittedly secretive process to redraw the state lines. And according to the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that's currently before the U.S. Supreme Court, it was very distinctly designed to benefit throughout the life of the plan, the Republicans who drew it. And so that was one story. Another story we will be releasing sometime in the next several weeks to months, depending on when we can get them out the door, has to do with campaign finance. Wisconsin has, like many states, been affected by Citizens United, but we also have some unique both law changes and court decisions that have affected the ability of citizens in our state to really know who's paying for these political ads and who's supporting which candidates. So that will be rolling out. We are looking at various ways the legislature hides some of what it does in the budget and other ways from the citizens. And so we're looking at the specific mechanisms that are used there. One story, we just called it We the Irrelevant, which is actually the same name as a local citizens group that started tracking citizen participation in various controversial bills to find out where did the citizens stand and then where do the politicians stand. And it won't surprise you to hear that there's a big gap there on some of the most controversial issues facing the state. And then lastly, we looked at voter ID. So that requirement has been in on again, off again since it was passed in 2011. It's on again now, although there is one lingering legal challenge still out there, but it may or may not be decided before this year's elections.
We'll dig into redistricting in particular in just a bit, but big picture, are we in a different political landscape in some ways than we were, say, 10, 15 years ago with the combination of all those changes you're looking at?
Yeah, definitely in a different place, but I don't want it to sound as though all of these changes came in 2011 when Scott Walker came into the office, or that it's only Republicans. You know, Democrats were given the chance to change our redistricting system when they controlled state government and just did not do it. Now we've heard from Democrats that they didn't do it because it wasn't a big burning issue. Every other time they tried to redistrict, there was a disagreement between the houses or the governor's office, and courts ended up drawing a map that was probably more fair in the end. It just wasn't a big burning issue. But Republicans have staked this out as a very strong issue for them, not just in Wisconsin, but nationwide through a project called Red Map. And that was highly successful. They flipped hundreds of legislative seats in dozens of states and allowed then, as a result of that effort, Republicans to really control redistricting in many parts of the country.
Talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about a new series on changes to representation here in Wisconsin, to the way we do politics and government. And let's focus in on redistricting and the Supreme Court case. We are waiting each Monday, we're watching for the U.S. Supreme Court to drop its ruling on our case here in Wisconsin. We're not the only game in town, though. There are other redistricting cases around the state. What's going on?
Well, there is a case that the U.S. Supreme Court also took up several months after the Wisconsin case. A little bit of a surprise to people, but it's a case of alleged gerrymandering by Democrats in Maryland. And so it's interesting to put those two together to try to figure out, is there a way to say when that kind of line drawing is unconstitutional, that it's so unfair toward one particular political party that it simply cannot stand. So I think, you know, the common wisdom is that the U.S. Supreme Court was trying to insulate itself a little bit from charges of partisanship if they were to, for example, uphold Wisconsin's redistricting and then not take up Maryland's redistricting. Would they be seen as favoring Republicans? Or if they overturn our redistricting maps, would they be seen as being partisan toward the Democrats? So this feels like it insulates it a little bit. At least that's what experts say.
Right. I think in your reporting, Chief Justice Roberts had said, raised that explicit worry, like, if we rule for the Democrats here, do people view us as a Democratic U.S. Supreme Court?
Right, which seems unlikely to happen. But I think it was, what he's nodding to is it is a very political mechanism. And it is one that has been used very strongly by both parties to maintain their advantage. And any changes that are made could affect one or both parties significantly. And so I think they are concerned about having the appearance of partisanship. Beyond that, the court has previously wrestled with this issue and just simply threw up its hands in earlier cases, trying to figure out, how do you measure what's too unfair? What would a fair measurement be of unfairness? And they were unable to do that. So what we're looking at now is various measurements that have been proposed that would measure what the likely outcome would be under various scenarios and whether one party has a distinct and like almost insurmountable advantage based on the way the redistricting is handled.
We've seen rulings based on racial bias, alleged racial bias in redistricting, but this is over partisan bias. And what some people, including the plaintiffs here, are saying is, as I understand it, okay, in the old days, you had a pencil and you were drawing along a map and coming up with the best redistrict you could. Now there are computer programs that can say, okay, what if this neighbor is in this district and their next door neighbor is in the other district? It can get a lot finer. We can try thousands of different permutations to find exactly the thing. When does it become too extreme?
Right. And that's another thing that's new now, even than 10 years ago, and certainly 20 or 30 years ago, is this pinpoint precision that map makers can apply to the task. And so if you look at, we ran a little map of the three of the assembly districts in the Madison area, and you can see just very distinct carve-outs. It's just very Swiss cheesy looking. Ideally these districts would be rather horizontal or square rather than these kind of raggedy-edged things that you see here and in many other states, including North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Maryland.
We're talking to Dee Hall right now, co-founder and managing editor for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She's with us to talk about a new series there called Undemocratic. It looks at political issues like gerrymandering we've been talking about that impact Wisconsin's democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the state of Wisconsin politics, how things have changed maybe over the last 10 or 20 years? What would you like to see changed? What do you think about the way redistricting works here, campaign finance, voter ID laws, and more? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how the state of Wisconsin's democracy is changing in an era of campaign money, dark money, people call it, gerrymandering, and more. Dee Hall is with us, co-founder and managing editor for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, part of a series there called Undemocratic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about campaign finances or redistricting in the state? And are these issues that you are concerned about, worried about, active on, something that you would base a vote on maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Stephen is with us in Madison. Stephen, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to ask, why is it necessary to really change these district lines to begin with? It seems that whenever this issue is brought up, really in any state, it's purely for the sake of political advantage. So I guess in my mind, why even make it a process at all? What's the benefit to it, and why is it necessary?
Stephen, thanks for the call. As I understand it, Dee, we have to, right? I think we're constitutionally required.
Well, we are required. I don't recall if it's the Constitution or a federal law, but what happens is you can imagine an area like Madison is growing, and you could get to the point where you would have one member of Congress, for example, representing a million people in one place, and then another member of Congress representing, 50,000 people. If you look at what LA used to be like, what Chicago, all these big cities, as the cities grow, and they have, and as communities and states grow, the population shifts. And what they're trying to do is have relatively equal representation or number of people per district, both legislatively and in Congress, so that each person ostensibly his or her vote counts the same as any other person in any other district.
So that every 10 years we get the census, and then in Wisconsin, whoever's in power in government, if anyone runs the whole show, they are in charge of drawing that map.
Right. And population shifts can be pretty significant. You can lose or gain entire congressional seats based on what the census shows. And so it's important to keep track of that, because otherwise you end up with some states that maybe, 100 years ago had a lot of people in them having more power and more representation in Congress than states that like California that have grown astronomically.
Thanks for that call, Stephen. We'll go next to Randy on the line in Superior. Randy, hi.
Hi. I got a question about why not simplify. Actually, it will clear up who represents me by simply stating it's by counties.
Well, that would be easier. Unfortunately, you've got the same problem there. Milwaukee County has so many more people than Vilas County, for example. And so if Vilas County had one representative and Milwaukee County had one representative, then you would have a grand imbalance in terms of the power of the people in Milwaukee, for example, versus Vilas County. So it sounds lovely and simple, but it wouldn't really work out, I don't think.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Derry on Facebook. An individual's vote, Derry says, does not matter in Wisconsin because of gerrymandering. And we've seen, and you report on this, your team reports on this in the piece on redistricting, Dee, there is pushback on this. There are movements around the state to try to change the way we do this.
Yes. So there are citizen groups and even national groups coming in to try to push for nonpartisan redistricting, similar to what Iowa does, in which you put the task in the hands of a nonpartisan governmental body. And then you put some restrictions around it. You say, you can't take into account, for example, where the current office holders live. That would be quite an unpopular one, I think, among our legislators and members of Congress. You can't take into account the political, you know, voting leanings of the different districts. They're supposed to be relatively regularly shaped. So those are some of the proposals that people are pushing right now. But yeah, they're going around and trying to get as many county boards as possible and as many individuals to support that.
Let's bring on another caller now. Paul is with us in Lincoln County. Paul, hi.
Hello. Yes, I am a county board supervisor here in Lincoln County, and my colleague Hans Breitenmoser drafted a resolution which our county board passed, and other counties have picked it up. So there are now 39 counties, I believe, at last count, who have passed on this anti-gerrymandering resolution or some form of it. So counties have continued to pile on, and I think there's probably not been enough publicity, quite frankly, as to what the counties have been doing. And our county passed this thing overwhelmingly. And if you look at which candidate this county voted for in the last presidential election, it voted for Trump, and yet our county board has overwhelmingly voted for an anti-gerrymandering resolution.
Paul, have you heard anything from state lawmakers about your resolution?
Basically nothing. I mean, our two legislators from this particular district, Assembly and Senate, are both Republicans, and they've been absolutely mute.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. And, do you have thoughts on that?
I was just going to ask Paul if he's still on the line.
I am.
What are your thoughts about gerrymandering and gerrymandering? What are the problems that you see as an office holder? And, of course, you have a nonpartisan office, but what are the problems you see?
Well, as far as the county elections go, that is to say for supervisors, I don't see a problem. The problem lies at the level of the state legislature and, of course, of Congress. And, I mean, we had, for instance, we had Bill Whitford, who's one of the plaintiffs in the suit that's now brought before the U.S. Supreme Court and for which answer from the Supreme Court we're waiting. And Mr. Whitford came up with a colleague of his, and they very meticulously went through the steps by which the gerrymandering was achieved in Wisconsin and how absolutely devious it was and it remains until it's changed. So including the fact, I think I'm going to guess here at the numbers, in 2014 the Democrats got something like, I don't know, was it 100,000 more votes than Republicans statewide? And yet they only got a third of the assembly seats.
And I'm going to bring you down there. Paul, we just have a few moments left. Dee, any quick thoughts on what he had to say?
No, I think that is the very issue right there, is whether the will of the majority of the voters is actually taken into account, or whether certain voters, depending on their party, are actually not as powerful. Their votes are not as powerful as others.
We'll leave it there for now. Dee, thanks for joining us, and we'll watch for the rest of the series.
Thanks a lot.
That's Dee Hall, co-founder and managing editor for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about the WCIJ's ongoing series, Undemocratic, which looks at the state of Wisconsin's democracy in an era of redistricting controversies, tighter voting laws, and more. You can follow those stories in the series at wisconsinwatch.org. Matt Flynn has been part of Wisconsin politics for 40 years. He's been a Democratic Party insider and a contender, but he's never won. That's left him introducing himself to many voters for the first time in this year's crowded race for governor. In our ongoing series on the race, Sean Johnson has this profile.
Matt Flynn is a Navy veteran, the former chair of the state Democratic Party, and a longtime attorney for a major Milwaukee law firm. He's also the face of the marijuana legalization movement in the 2018 governor's race. It made him a welcome guest recently at a new store called Herb RX in Sun Prairie, where Flynn learned about products made from the hemp-derived substance CBD.
And these edibles, what are these?
These are gummies, so you get four of these in the bag. They look like frogs.
Owner Jacob Coates doesn't sell anything containing THC, the compound that gives marijuana users a high. Flynn tells Coates that could change if he's elected because he wants to legalize marijuana and pardon anyone serving time for nonviolent marijuana offenses.
Maybe you'll be our first seller of marijuana.
Yeah,
legally.
That would be the best.
Legally.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, legally. Okay.
Flynn says pushing this issue wouldn't have been possible when he got his start in politics. And given how long ago that was, he might be right. Flynn, who's now 70, ran his first campaign for Congress in 1978 and became the first in a long line of Democrats to lose to Republican U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner.
It was a clearly Republican district, and I'm a Democrat, but in those days, I was 30 years old. So in those days, you know you're immortal.
Flynn became chair of the state Democratic Party from 1981 to 1985. In 1986, he ran for U.S. Senate, facing Ed Garvey in the Democratic primary. It was a combative race.
You know, it was basically like two Irish guys with short tempers and who could speak. And so we were going back and forth.
Flynn came up short, losing by fewer than 25,000 votes. In 1988, it seemed like the stars were aligning for Flynn. He now lived in a Democratic congressional district, and incumbent Congressman Jim Moody was leaving to run for U.S. Senate. So Flynn ran for Congress again with the support of Democrats like longtime U.S. Senator Bill Proxmire.
His name is Matt Flynn. Matt Flynn's among the most honorable, bright, and decent young men I've ever encountered in public life.
But things fell apart quickly when multimillionaire Herb Kohl decided to run for Senate. That drove Moody out of the Senate race. He went back to run for his old congressional seat and beat Flynn easily.
That happens. You know, Winston Churchill said that politics is just like war, except you can be killed 17 times. And so I've been killed probably 10 or 11 times, but I have some more lives left in me.
It would be 2004 before Flynn ran for office again. But by that time, he'd spent 15 years as the lawyer for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, defending the Catholic Church against priest sexual abuse allegations. Flynn's work was an issue in that campaign, and he lost again. And as Flynn runs for governor in 2018, his work for the Archdiocese is resurfacing.
Yes, this absolutely disqualifies him from being governor.
Sarah Pearson of the group Women's March Wisconsin has helped publicize details of Flynn's work for the Archdiocese. That includes a $25,000 severance payment he oversaw to a priest convicted of sexual assault of a teenager. Pearson called on Flynn to drop out of the race.
As a leader of a progressive group, I know that in order to be successful in 2018, we need to put the strongest candidate forward, and Matt Flynn is not that person.
Flynn says that as a lawyer for the Archdiocese, he was doing his job.
I think any discerning person looks at this and says, Matt Flynn is one of the top lawyers in Wisconsin, and he handled these cases very well professionally. Somebody had to represent the Archdiocese, and I did it. And I'm very proud to have done it.
Flynn has been through all of this before. Asked what makes this campaign different, the longtime Democrat answers without a flinch. Compare him to the other candidates, Flynn says, and he's the best one. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.